Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of Extra Serving, a restaurant industry podcast by The Last Bite Network, a product of Nation's Restaurant News and Restaurant Hospitality. I'm your host, Holly Petrie, here with the latest episode. Before we get into that, here's some news from The Last Bite Network that's been happening in the past few weeks. Be sure to check out the latest episode of Takeaway with Sam Okus featuring AJ Kumaran, co-CEO of Raising Cane's. Over on Restaurant Hospitality, Brett Thorne's latest episode of In the Kitchen features Michael Reed of Poppy and Rose in Los Angeles. And now it's time to introduce my two co-hosts for this episode.
My name is Sam Okus, editor-in-chief of Nation's Restaurant News.
And my name is Leanne Zinsmeister, managing editor of Nation's Restaurant News.
Welcome, Leanne. Welcome, Sam. Happy February.
Hello. Yes, indeed.
You both seemed so enthused.
We're bringing the energy today. We're all brain dead on a Friday. Yeah.
I'm not a winter person. If you have me on for like the first week of June, I'll muster up some more enthusiasm.
We got to rotate Leanne out.
May. We get a nice May here.
You guys getting more snowstorm today?
No.
It's just ice.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, you know, until 5 minutes ago, my window was open. It's almost 70 here. So no big deal.
I was sweating earlier.
I'm moving to North Carolina. Hold on.
I know. You know, don't get me wrong. This is, I my family hates this. Whenever it's like 70 and it's like, you know, 40 in Ohio where my family is, I love to rub that in. Now, as I am preparing to move back to Ohio, I am going to eat my own words for all these years in North Carolina.
I'm currently sweating here. I went outside yesterday and I was like, I don't even need a coat. And it was like 38 degrees. And I think the winter broke me this year.
Guess so. That's a, you might want to work on that. You need to understand that hot and cold are like how to prepare for each of these things.
Winter this year just damaged me. And I was like, 38 degrees. It's very warm outside. Who needs a coat?
I haven't been outside since Monday.
That's fair.
It's Friday now for people wondering when
you were outside on Tuesday. We were in the office on Tuesday.
You're right. We went to the office on Tuesday. I haven't been outside since Tuesday.
I say this lovingly, but you need to get out more. You need to get some fresh air. Go for a walk. Come on. The sidewalks can't be that bad right now.
They're not. They're clear.
Yeah. Go for a walk.
All right. Bye.
Not right now.
Haven't you seen all those TikToks of people walking outside, those doing their like mental health walks in New York, and they're doing their TikToks and they're just going, and they have their arms. I'm doing it. You can't see it because this is an audio format, but
Holly,
I'm doing like a robot.
Let me ask you a question. Do you think I have seen those TikToks? Do you really think I have seen the TikToks of people going for walks in New York?
You have a TikTok now.
I don't think I should advertise this at all. I felt very, very old when I downloaded. Ugh, gross. I don't look at it. Don't follow me because you will not be rewarded. That's just a warning. And frankly, if we're being all honest here, I have a TikTok so I can make sure that Holly can appropriately manage the NRN TikTok, which also now exists. That's probably more a call to action here that we should direct people to is go follow NRN on TikTok. Don't expect too much. Don't have grand aspirations for what this will be because Holly's the one that's going to be posting things on there. That's right. I said it. Mm-hmm.
That is so trash.
I mean, you're doing a better job than I would have ever done with TikTok. So, and I mean, I guess they're good by TikTok standards.
My jaw's on the floor, listeners. Right. Listeners, my jaw is on the floor in the basement of my building right now. Maybe it's in the gutters. Like, my jaw is dropped.
I just know which buttons to push. That's all.
So wildly offended right now by this old man.
Yep, I accept that.
With his creaking bones is so offending me.
And the grays that are coming in.
Oh, my goodness.
I embrace
things you can look forward to in your 30s, Holly.
That's right.
I'm never turning 30. I don't know what
you're going gray.
I told you that earlier. I'm staying 29 forever.
Yes, that is
good luck with that. Yeah.
I mean, I still have 2 years, but when I turn 29, it will be 29 forever.
I don't know. You know how you feel toward people in their early 20s, Holly, where you're like, ugh, kids Monsters. And their behaviors. Yeah, right. Well, that's how we feel. Those of us in our 30s feel about people in their 20s, which, of course, people listening to this who are in their 40s are probably like, I think that about you in your 30s. But
they're not listening because it's not you even and me, Sam. They're like these children.
Yes, exactly. What do I have to learn from these people? But you get to graduate into, you know, looking down your nose at the younger people and, you know, more officially do that when you're in your 30s toward the people in their 20s.
Yes, everyone looks their nose down at you, Sam.
Well, everybody who's probably older than me, sure.
Just everybody.
And they have earned that right. That's what we're getting to here, which is you have earned that right when you get old to look down your nose at the people who are younger than you. This is why there was the whole thing about millennials and everybody rolls their eyes about millennials. Now, millennials, what are we doing? We're rolling our eyes about Gen Z. And we think we make these big, you know, proclamations about these generational things and whatever. Anyway, if we go back to like New Year's resolutions, maybe one I should add is figuring out how to appreciate the unique gifts of Gen Z. Maybe that's something I need to do. Maybe we all need to just work harder. I think I'm talking myself back into like I'm changing my own opinion actively here. I don't even know what's happening.
You're gonna love TikTok, Sam. I think you're gonna love
yeah,
TikTok.
That's what's happening is I'm going to actually go crazy with TikTok. I'm going to become addicted to it and be doing dances on it in no time.
I don't think you're gonna go that far, but I mean, I think there are some trends you're going to really love. There's some really funny kid stuff on there that I can see you getting your kids involved in it because your kids are really cute and I can see them going viral.
Yeah, but I don't want my kids to look at TikTok because I don't want to set some example that like they, when they get their first phones, they have to do TikTok because then I don't want them to be addicted to social media, but we'll see. We do dance parties here in the Okus household. So maybe that's TikTok fodder.
Yeah, I mean, your kids are adorable, and I just feel like they're going to do well on the internet.
Okay, that's good to know. So, maybe I should go for like endorsements and things like that.
Yes, monetize.
See, every parent wants to have the next, I don't know if you heard of this kid, Ryan, who unboxes things on YouTube. There's this kid, and he just started unboxing things on YouTube, which don't ask me why that's a thing kids like to do, but I see my own kids get transfixed by unboxing videos. It doesn't make any sense to me. That kid made like $30 million last year. He's so popular. So every parent with young kids secretly wants to take advantage of their cute kids and find that next $30 million a year idea. So maybe that's what it is for me, TikTok videos.
You mean it's a surprise that people want to make $30 million a year off of their children?
Surprising, right? I know. Yeah, who knew people would want $30 million a year? But at what cost is what I ask? Because then, I don't know, does your kid grow up in some la-la land? Like, you can't grow up as a regular kid when you're making $30 million off your YouTube channel.
True. But I feel like you've just given the first argument that Holly's ever heard that might make her want to have children.
That's true.
Can you see it in her eyes? She's like, Wait,
I can make money off these things?
Huh. You don't have to marry rich, Holly. You can just have a baby and make them rich.
No, the things that are going through my mind right now. Do you want to know what's going through my mind immediately right now?
Or does our audience? Because if the answer is audience, maybe we take it offline.
The answer is, how can I actively connect this to Kevin Johnson's pay raise?
Oh, you want to do a segue. I get it.
Segue into one of our stories this week, which is the CEO of Starbucks got a pay raise.
He sure did. Big one.
Big one. Big pay raise. Let's talk about it. There was a great segue in there. Couldn't think of it. So I'm just going to say I was thinking of it. I was thinking of it somewhere there.
He's still making less than that kid opening boxes on YouTube, though.
He's no Brian Nickel.
Well, true. We've got tiers here. We have Brian Nickel. We have Ryan on YouTube unboxing videos. And we've got Kevin Johnson down here.
We can't all be Brian Nickels. Even Ryan's not going to be a Brian Nickel. I mean, he has somewhere to live up to.
I guess so.
So let's talk about Kevin.
Have you asked a question? You know that our format here is usually you're supposed to ask us a question. Do you want to just launch into it?
Just launch right into it. So let's talk about, it's a 40% pay increase in 2021. The
the chain Starbucks, you know, they raised prices to combat inflation twice in 3 months. They raised prices for consumers, but sales were up 18% in 2021. So, you know, they did see some increase, but it's not like sales were up 40% in 2021.
I want to make sure we're being clear here that his salary, like his pay increase, was only just over 6%. And the rest of the increase was made up in stocks and
other, as it always is, yes,
compensation. Yeah, but I just want to make sure they didn't like give him a 40%
raise. Yes.
There's not an apples oranges. No. There's not an apples oranges comparison here between the money he's receiving that equals the 40% raise and the prices passed on to customers, et cetera, et cetera. But anyway, right. Go on.
That's how people's pays were made up at this level. But unfortunately, or fortunately, that's not how the pay is actually made up at the CEO level. It's often made up of stocks and bits in the company and bits and pieces. And yes, so we are fully aware of that.
I'm sorry, have you asked a question yet, or are we supposed to start talking?
Oh my God, Sam!
Okay. Well, if you're asking me what I think of this, I think this is, I mean, look, he should have at least thought about optics on this. I mean, this is just not great timing for something like this, particularly at a time when the wage debate's been going on for years. I don't know. Look, I have never been the CEO of a major national global restaurant chain before. And so I think we often roll our eyes at a lot of these pay raises. And then, you know, of course, there's a lot of nuance to it that we don't understand. But I mean, if we were only to look at it from the perspective of, you know, optics, it's not good optics when you keep giving the CEO big raises, but you are, you know, continue to do, you know, minimum wage jobs. The bulk of your workforce is minimum wage jobs. Yes, there's a big difference between the person who's running the company and the barista in terms of their, you know, responsibilities, et cetera. But it has got to be something you consider when you give your CEO a big pay raise, even if it includes stocks and what have you. If you're not also giving your workforce a nice raise. Now, I will say Starbucks, I think, tends to be one of the better ones when it comes to employee pay. You know, they're generally better about paying more than a minimum wage. They also have, you know, stock option thing for their employees too. I mean, so you know, keeping in mind that there has been a lot that they've done for their employees over the years, it's just not great to give yourself a huge raise when the wage debate is ongoing and when inflation is so bad. And when, by the way, Starbucks, even though, you know, they just reported their sales was like an 18% increase in sales, but broadly speaking, I don't think Starbucks has had a great couple of years. You know, forget financials. I just think reputation wise, I think Starbucks has a lot of challenges, a lot of things that they are facing in the public sphere generally. And so this is just doesn't look good, you know?
Yeah, they've also, in that period where sales went up, same store sales increased 18%, they also raised prices twice just in that time period. I agree with Sam. I mean, it's really about optics here. You know, Starbucks stores are unionizing, organizing. So it's clear that a lot of the lower level employees aren't happy. And so the optics of having a bump like that at the top is not ideal.
Well, yeah, there was just this there's news that, you know, maybe possibly 50 Starbucks stores are going to start unionizing, that you know, there's going to be this wave of stores that could start unionizing, and 50 could lead to 100, could lead to 1,000, could lead to a nationwide Starbucks union. We could be seeing, this is all speculation, by the way, this is not, I just want to say that, I just want to say we don't know anything. We don't have the inside track, though we do have a very interesting story by Joanna Fantozzi on the Starbucks unions coming out in the next few days on our website. Starbucks has seen a lot of press issues lately too. They saw a lot of issues with the Black Lives Matter protests, saw a lot of issues with Pride over the past few years. They've seen a lot of issues that have kind of been speed bumps in the way that they've been portrayed in the media, that have brought issues with customers, that have brought them a lot of publicity issues that have led to dips in sales. That doesn't look great combined with a rise in prices. That doesn't look great with lower wages for employees. That doesn't look great with a higher wages for the CEO. Like, it's just not good optics.
Yeah, look, I think that Starbucks has a unique position here, which is that they are a much more visible company than many other restaurant companies, especially because they're high prevalence of stores in urban areas, right? And so I think, you know, they typically are seen as more of a quote unquote progressive kind of company. And I think when you get kind of put forward as a, you know, very national company, very in the media company, and generally considered a progressive company, I think they're held to sometimes a little bit of a different standard, for better or worse. And so, I mean, to your point, Holly, I think a lot of the, let's call them controversies that Starbucks has gone through, I don't think it was, you know, it was nothing that was that unique to Starbucks. It's just that they have a different kind of position in the zeitgeist, if you will, than a lot of other restaurant companies do. And I think a lot of restaurant companies are pretty smart about keeping mum on a lot of various societal things because, you know, they just want to be a business. They want their food to speak for itself, and they let that be. And that is, and that's another way to do business. Starbucks is just not that. And so if you put yourself forward as being like, we want to, you know, have a position on this issue or this issue, it comes with the flip side of being held to account a lot more so than other restaurant companies, I guess. And so, yeah, I mean, especially if you're seen as a quote unquote progressive restaurant company, and then, you know, you also see your CEO give yourself a 40% pay raise in the midst of a labor crisis, where at the core of that issue is that workers want to be paid more. It's going to be much more of a hot button issue than if another restaurant company were to go through the same thing.
It's interesting. We talked about this a little bit when we're talking about pay raises. You know, we talk about Chipotle. We talk about Brian Nichol he's the highest paid restaurant CEO in the country. Chipotle workers on the whole are still not making $15 an hour. I mean, they spoke about trying to raise the average wage to be that, but you know, Chipotle workers at minimum are not making $15 an hour. That's not the minimum wage across Chipotle stores. Chipotle is trying to be a sustainable company. They're trying to do all this, but Chipotle's not as visible on a lot of these issues as Starbucks is. So they're not getting as much flack for Brian Nichol's salary, and they're not as, he hasn't seen as many raises as Kevin Johnson has. So I'm curious how these two companies, how you guys think that they compare, and why we haven't seen as much of the controversy fall on Chipotle as we're seeing on Starbucks.
I think there was a similar conversation around Chipotle last year. I think those numbers came out last April, and you know, we just don't remember it as vividly because the Starbucks conversation is happening this week. But I think there was an outcry. Honestly, outside of our little B2B bubble, I feel like I saw more of an outcry about Chipotle's CEO salary than I'm seeing about Starbucks. I don't think that I don't actively seek out consumer restaurant news, but I don't think I've come across a headline about Kevin Johnson outside of our B2B world this week. So I actually don't really see much of a difference in the way those two conversations have played out. I think that the Kevin Johnson conversation will frankly die down in a couple of weeks. And I also, as a consumer, I see Starbucks and Chipotle as having similar values, or at least portraying their values in a similar way to the consumer. So I actually don't really see much of a difference in these conversations personally.
Some of it's timing, because the timing of this with Starbucks is at a time where inflation is just really a big part of the conversation in the industry right now. I don't think a year ago the labor situation was nearly what it is right now. I mean, of course, the wage conversation was going on a year ago, but it's just different right now. The landscape, the restaurant landscape, and everything that's going on is just so different than what it was then. So, that's probably why, you know, there's a little bit more of an outcry here. But again, yeah, if I could just like wrap up the pay part of this, it's just to say, like, I cannot tell you whether it's right or wrong to pay CEOs this much. But I can tell you that it's been pretty proved that you should pay your workers more and you'll get more out of them. But also the last thing I can say that is right or wrong is the optics piece of this is like, you know, whether or not you think your CEO deserves millions more as a raise, that's up to you to figure out whether that's right or wrong. But what the timing at which you do that and whether it's going to look good or not, I mean, that seems pretty clear to me. So, also, by the way, can we all remember 2 years ago when CEOs were foregoing salaries in the midst of the pandemic to help with their employees, et cetera, et cetera? Like that was short lived. And I don't know. It's just so it does kind of blow my mind that that anybody would think that this time is a good time to give a very, very big raise.
Well, not to beat a dead horse, but Starbucks also reported this week.
They sure did.
We have news that came out of Starbucks reporting. Let's talk about, you know, the Q4 earnings. What are your thoughts?
Well, again, it just seems like, I mean, I think this is kind of the same story with a lot of companies right now, which is sales are okay. Sales are pretty good even. If you look at it purely from a sales perspective, I think things are humming along. And Omicron was not as bad to the restaurant business from a sales perspective as the original wave of the pandemic was. However, inflation and labor are putting the squeeze on restaurant companies so that despite an 18% sales climb for Starbucks, it wasn't so rosy from a, you know, profit standpoint and from their actual financial health, because they have to increase their prices to account for inflation. The labor pressures, you know, cost pressures because of inflation, everything is just putting a squeeze on it. So I think this is pretty similar across other restaurant companies. We're coming into reporting week here next week to see the earnings reports of other companies. So I think we'll have a better sense of that industry-wide, but I'm guessing we're going to see a lot of what Starbucks is seeing. Like sales are good. Like in the midst of a pandemic, people continue to come, you know, they're still doing drive-through, they're ordering from their phone. Great. But we're paying more for our cups and we're paying more for our chicken. And, you know, so, unfortunately I don't think it's a lot to be that optimistic about despite those sales numbers.
They still have, in some cases, shorter store hours as well right now related to the labor issues. So there's a lot of pressure on Starbucks. And I agree with Sam, we're going to see this across the board as we start getting more and more earnings in the next couple of weeks.
Well, we went to the office this week. You and I went to Starbucks, Leanne.
We did.
That's we true. Were inside of a Starbucks. We went, we ordered pistachio lattes to try for Menu Tracker. We did a very special, cool Menu Tracker video that'll be out next week. Sort of a summary of a monthly Menu Tracker, new series we're doing. But we tried the pistachio latte, very interesting. But we were inside of a Starbucks and it was nice to be inside of a Starbucks again. And to be, you know, like smelling the coffee and like around business people, like in business suits, and just it like felt normal.
Business people in business suits is normal to you. That's spoken like a true New Yorker.
And yeah, then me and Holly walking up to the counter and asking for two giant pistachio lattes and like half a dozen straws. So
yep, just like normal. Back to normalcy. Yeah. I mean, look, it's funny because you know, I mean, for so many people, like normal never left, right? I mean, it's just a curious reality. I mean, you guys feel it so much more there in New York. Obviously, early in the pandemic, with things really clearing out, but even now, it seems like New York is still really, you know, it's not back to humming like it usually does. But you know, here in the suburbs, it feels like nothing ever changed. And so, yeah, what is normal? Who knows? Will we ever feel it again? I don't know. But yes, as Omicron recedes, I think we're all figuring out what it means to kind of like go into hiding with a surge and then ease our way back out. And we're all in the easing our way back out process again. So that is definitely a relief, I would say, from my perspective.
Well, and, you know, building on that, the NRA released its latest forecast of the restaurant industry, that the industry is set to hit $898 billion this year. That is right. I got the billion versus million right, finally. So people are, you know, it's what we were saying. People are still buying. It's increasing. Like people are we're eating. The industry's on the move. It's going up. I mean, it's good. These are good things.
Yeah, but yeah, with the, again, caveat that inflation makes that so, you know, even though that number is on par with what things were pre-pandemic, inflation makes it so that it's actually lagging by like 11% as to a real business. But yeah, I mean, you know, if we want to at least compare things to 2020, when the industry took a, what, $250 billion dip, to be back to essentially pre-pandemic levels is still a good thing. But there's work to be done. And, you know, inflation very much out of the control of the industry. I think that's one, you know, one pretty serious issue, which is like labor. There are things you can do to solve for labor. You know, certainly there are ways you can solve for getting around various coronavirus related challenges. You know, you could do things with service, et cetera. You can't really do anything about inflation. You know, there's you know, as far as like your supply partners and what you pay and cost things, you know, there's deals you can cut, you can have better relationships maybe with vendors, like there's some things you can do, but by and large, inflation is not, you know, that's a bigger issue than the restaurant industry. And so unfortunately that wave is going to have to just be kind of rode out. But yeah, at least sales are going the right direction according to projections. And I think everybody just has to sort of cross their fingers and hope that we don't get another Omicron type surge in 2022 in order to fulfill actual real growth.
It's also worth pointing out that we were talking about how, you know, big chain restaurants are doing okay right now. But a lot of the small independent restaurants, that industry is really still suffering almost as much as they ever were. Just a couple of weeks before their state of the industry report, the NRA said that 46% of restaurants who didn't get government aid last year think that they could close their doors this year. So a lot of the success is great, but it's really concentrated with the big guys while the little guys are still suffering.
So there's a real perspective issue here too. I mean, which is like, you know, it's cold comfort for us to talk about the industry's rebound when 46% of restaurants still likely feel like they could close at any time. And the industry needs those people. I mean, the country needs those restaurants. You know, it's so all of this is such a very complicated, you know, framework that supports each other, right? Like, we need independent restaurants. We need them for the jobs. We need the, and so if that end of the industry suffers, ultimately it will affect the big chain types as well. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, we can't solve anything here on this call, certainly, but, you know, we have to do step back and look at the health of the overall industry and continue to encourage, by the way, if we want to talk about the early days of the pandemic again, you know, think about how much attention was paid to supporting your local restaurants. I think we should encourage that again, right? Like we got to get back to a point where we are, you know, looking not toward the growth of the industry, but look at where it continues to lag and figure out how we can pull up that side of the industry as well.
Well, you guys, thank you so much for your insight. We will be right back with an interview with Jonathan Wethington, CEO of Shuck and Shack. Well, so let's talk about Shuck and Shack. It's so exciting. I was reading all about Shuck and Shack. I was starved. I love oysters. So I was just reading all about you guys and I was just like drooling because oysters are one of my favorite foods. So you guys are growing, which is so exciting. I love when brands are growing, when small brands are growing. You're currently at 16 units. But you know, you signed 6 franchise deals. You have 5 on the way. You're growing. How have you established that growth and how are you going to maintain it?
I think one of the things that we're doing is we're being selective with the people that we bring in. And that sounds crazy. but even for a brand our size, you know, the people that we bring here for approval day as a part of our development process, we're making sure that they're going to work long-term with the system. We don't look at it as a transactional relationship, meaning, hey, you've got the money to write the check, come on in. That's not how we look at it. We look at it more of, we know that's going to be a 10-year commitment at least. And, you know, we plan on sticking it out, and we want whoever we're bringing into our system to best represent Shuck and Shack for the next 10 plus years. And sometimes that means making hard decisions when we're talking about, you know, onboarding folks and onboarding potential new franchisees. But we've kind of taken that approach for quite some time. And right now, or at least, you know, dating back to the first of 2021 through last year, it's finally starting to take hold. You know, you can be selective and create scarcity in the market, and eventually you're going to get the best. And that's what we feel like we've done.
I mean, talk about scarcity. I got a release from you guys that said that you got over 900 franchise leads, and you're just finalizing five. I mean, that's scarcity. That's, you've created that.
Yeah. I mean, and that was intentional on our part. You know, sometimes it's hard to look folks in the face and even walk away from folks who are genuinely interested in what you're doing. But at the end of the day, they consider you a line item, or just consider you a part of their portfolio. And so for us, it was, hey, do these folks, are they just going to be great representations? And that naturally created scarcity, because we said no to deals that maybe other people would have done. And, you know, quite frankly, maybe we should have done and been more, been less stringent rather on some of our requirements, but we just haven't been willing to do that thus far. And so that's created a really good vibe within our system. You know, we have our annual conference every year with all of our franchisees. Our franchisees are happy. They validate well. They do well. Our business has grown year over year. Not only has our footprint grown, but our AUV has grown every year. And so we fully intend on continuing to do that.
What do you look for in a franchisee? It sounds like you have some very stringent, not stringent, but it just seems like you really want some specific things. What can somebody expect to, what can they live up to?
Sure. So it's not as complicated as you might think. There's no giant algorithm or giant matrix of saying, hey, this personality trait fits here, and so that's a plus one, and this one doesn't quite fit, so that's minus five, or anything like that. We do some basic personality profiling, but more often than not, it simply boils down to, can this person have a conversation with the general public? And that's it. When we're in hospitality, and that means you never know who's going to walk through the door. And so making sure the franchisees that come into your system can handle the ups and the downs of that, because some days are going to be great, some days are not going to be so great. Can they be consistent enough? Do they know how to have conversations with people? Are they pleasant? Do you like them? Simple things like that go a really, really long way in selecting franchisees.
You know, we haven't really talked about what your brand is. And I'd love to kind of get into that, because that's a lot of how you've been able to reach out to this whole new base and how you've been able to get all of these franchising agreements, is people have been interested in what your brand is. So can you tell me a little bit about what Shuck and Shack is?
Sure. So if you go to our website, you know, what you see is what you get. That's pretty much what we are. We are completely upfront with exactly who we are. My 10-second elevator pitch to anyone who wants to listen is, if you like cold beer and you like fresh seafood, you're going to like us just fine. If you don't like those two things, we're not going to fit together very well. So, you know, it's pretty much that simple. We don't believe at the core of things that hospitality is all that difficult. We don't believe that it's all that complicated. We create it, we make it difficult, and some other brands and some places make it difficult because they put restrictions on what you should and shouldn't do. We believe that if people are pleasant, they treat other people well, and then they have a dynamite product to back it up, we believe that the sales will come, the service will come, you know, and then eventually your franchisees will come. It's just very basic. It sounds stupid, and it sounds like I'm not telling the truth by just saying that, but that is the 100% truth.
So, I mean, you know, you have this great elevator pitch. It really is a great elevator pitch. I mean, who's going to say no to cold beer and seafood? I feel like most of the population is not going to say no to that. It's a good elevator pitch. So how have you managed to attract your a local regional chain? How have you managed to attract all of these franchisees?
I think because we're just a refreshment in the market, honestly. We're not overcomplicating a lot of things. We're not making things a lot very difficult as far as conceptually what we're doing and what we're not doing. We're saying, hey, this is who we are. And if you're a good person and you wanted to run a restaurant or you want something different, you know, you've always been in the certain system, but you want a little bit of refresher and you can just be yourself, we're probably a great fit for you. If you don't want those things, then hey, we're probably not a great fit, and that's okay. You're still going to eat at our restaurants. And so that's just kind of the mantra that we take and the approach that we take to things.
So as you grow, you're going to be expanding to new markets. What is that like? And some of these markets may not have seafood as readily available as others. What is that going to be like as you grow and expand?
Sure. So that's a, you know, that's always a big challenge, right? When you're talking about supply chain, especially in light of COVID and the labor market and everything going on right now, as we expand, we work with a national supply chain management company. And so we buy products with about 1,400 other restaurants across the United States. And so for us, the distribution portion is not as complicated as you might think it is. And also looking at seafood, a lot of people are scared of seafood. And I think the underlying fear is that there are so many options. When you think about seafood, you're not talking about just one thing. You know, when you think about beef, yeah, it's graded differently and there's a few different cuts and all of those things. But when you think about seafood, you know, how many different fishes are there? A lot. But for us, we've simplified it. So we buy, as far as, you know, on a distribution standpoint, supply chain standpoint, we buy our shrimp a year at a time. So we do case commitments a year at a time. So as long as we're doing sales planning correctly enough, we know about what our sell-through is going to be, even as we're growing. And so we commit to that, you know, in the fall of every year. We do similar things throughout the year with other center of the plate items from distribution standpoint. And then there's a big educational component. And the educational component for us is making sure when we go inland that people understand that we have complete sourcing and complete tracking on all of our seafood that comes through. So oysters, for instance, they have about a 14-day shelf life. You know, we know exactly where those oysters came from, not just the state, you know, not just the general region, not even just the river or the bay. We know the box that they came out of when they were sourced, because most oysters at this point are aquaculture. So we can trace them back quite literally to, you know, a 25-foot by 25-foot section of the bay and say, this is exactly where your product came from. And so there's a big educational component that plays into that sourcing and supply chain as well.
You know, you talk about sourcing and supply chain, and a big part of your restaurant is also sustainability. It's, you talk about your website being clear and crisp, and a lot of that is sustainability. Can you talk about how sustainability plays into supply chain and your mission, and also, you know, how you're handling things like takeout and to go and all of these things that kind of play into the mission of sustainability?
Sure. So sustainability for us was almost by default. We kind of stumbled into it. We live at the coast. You know, I've grown up near the coast. I understand the importance of renourishment and choose making sustainable decisions as far as when you're sourcing things. And so for us, it was by default. It just so happened to become popular as it was something we were doing. We've been recycling oyster shells since the beginning. And whenever available, we do that at our locations. Unfortunately, a lot of those state programs and federal programs have been cut. But we were actually returning a lot of oyster shells back to their natural habitat. We have some locations that do that. In fact, if you're looking at 2019, actually one of our locations in the state of South Carolina recycled something like 5% of the oyster shells recycled in the entire state. So, you know, it's a big part of what we do. And then as we transition, when we're looking at the consumer side, you know, we're trying to make smart decisions and smart choices, even if it's a little bit more expensive. But again, that goes to an educational component. You know, we're choosing eco products that, you know, are not going to sit in a landfill and have a half-life of 50 years before they expire. We're using corn plastic and some in our to-go cups. And so the expiration on those and the breakdown of those is a much quicker life cycle, and it's recycled material. So it's more difficult, don't get me wrong, because I know what, you know, 10,000 styrofoam trays cost. It's certainly more expensive. But we feel from a long-term perspective, because everything that we source pretty much comes from the water, that we've got to do our best to take care of it.
Yeah, I was going to say, is the reason why you feel that it's worth the cost to get sustainably? I mean, there's a big portion of your website that talks about the straws that you guys use. Is there a big reason that you believe in sustainability because you draw from the ocean for the food that you serve?
Yeah, you nailed it. I mean, that's it. You know, you can't go, let's say, into your home and start pouring gasoline everywhere and then be surprised one day that it catches on fire. So we've just got to make sure that, yes, it's a slow burn on our end. And it seems like sometimes we get caught up in the minutia of things. But if we can make smarter decisions, especially when we're talking about on the consumer-driven side, then the better off we believe it'll be long-term. You don't see immediate returns on those things. You don't, let's face it. We're making decisions that may not have, you know, a significant impact on our generation, but we do believe that it's the right thing to do.
And is there any part of education that you do on the consumer side? I mean, I know that there's sometimes a disconnect between consumers and the business side when you're doing initiatives like this, when you are sustainably based. Are you guys doing anything to educate consumers?
You know, I would say that we're probably not taking an active role at the point of the customer interaction, meaning with our servers and bartenders, but that's just because that doesn't necessarily go along with, you know, how we train and the things that we decide to do in the restaurant with the customer interaction. But the reason that we don't hand out straws, if someone asks, hey, why didn't I get a straw? That's a great opportunity to tell them right then and there. You know, customers will tell you exactly what they want. You just have to be willing to listen to those opportunities and then interject when appropriate.
And then I'd love to hear, because we're recording at lunchtime, so I'd love to hear a little bit about the menu. Can you tell me some items on the menu, some things that we can expect as you grow and you come to states like New York, where I am, what we can expect on the menu?
Sure. So, you know, Northeast lobster rolls, you'll love lobster rolls up there. We have a genuine New England lobster roll that the recipe was actually honed in by a native Bostonian. So our lobster roll is really good. We put a small flair on it on our side. We serve it with a side of like a remoulade, which would be kind of a southern remoulade, kind of a spicy mustard style. Then we have, of course, all of your low country boil. Most of what we call our seafood is East Coast seafood. It is not Gulf seafood, meaning what we do from a preparation standpoint is very simple. So we steam seafood and we put it on a plate. It's pretty much that simple. So it's not spice heavy. It's not boiled in a bag. It's not caked with a ton of spices to hide the, you know, the poor quality of the ingredients. It's American sourced. It's great seafood. So lobster roll, low country boil. We have a lot of good sandwiches at lunchtime. A lot of people, rightfully so, associate us with an oyster bar, which we can get oysters from everywhere. But lots of great, you know, land options as well. Our burger is fantastic. And then on top of that, some great sandwiches and other platters that, you know, families can share. That's one of the things that we really like is the family style meals as well.
Oh my God, you've made me so hungry. I could go for a low country boil right now. Mm. So yeah. as you expand, do you imagine the menu changing depending on the region?
You know, we've already been doing that actually. Our base menu will stay the same. We don't have any intentions of changing that menu. However, as we've gone into new regions, we've developed what we call chalkboard specials, meaning if you're in the state of Maryland and you don't have a lump crab cake, you're not doing it correctly. And so we have developed a lump crab cake that mainly our Maryland store only serves, or the only one that serves that lump crab cake. However, it's available for the rest of our franchisees to serve. They want to do it on special for limited runs and things like that. So we've already done that. And we've been doing that for a little while to kind of speak to some of the local flair of what's popular regionally.
It sounds like it's really going to take off when you guys take over the country, which I feel like is going to happen very soon. So I'm very excited for your growth, and I can't wait. I can't wait till you guys take over the country. So thank you so much for your time, Jonathan. I so appreciated it.